Want to spend less money in the new year? Well, we have a story about how one person cut a big chunk of spending out of their life and learned a thing or two in the process. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, January 1st, 2020. Happy New Year, everyone. New Year's Day is a time that many of us reflect on our lives and how we're living them. Some folks sign up for a gym, others may decide to start eating healthier or save money. That brings us to the latest installment of our series, How We Shop. Today, we hear about a woman in Boise, Idaho, who set a New Year's resolution not to shop at all. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
It all started in 2017, on Christmas, when Haley Faulkner looked around her house and started to reevaluate her life choices.
It just felt like we were overtaken by stuff.
Shiny new plastic toys for her young sons, clothes, books, and piles of trash, boxes, tissue paper, wrapping paper. And even aside from the Christmas gifts, Faulkner realized that she and her husband Sean had already amassed a lot of stuff. 3 sets of dishes, 10 chapsticks, 17 containers of hand lotion.
I just felt like there was something that I could do about it and decided that I should stop buying things.
Faulkner decided to go on a shopping fast for 1 year. She set some rules. She would buy groceries, but no clothes or shoes or housewares. And if her sons really needed something, she would try to buy it secondhand. On New Year's Day in 2018, her hair clip broke, the one she used every day.
Spring busted and it was done and it was my only one. And I was pretty bummed out about it because I felt like I could not go out and buy something that felt inconsequential on the very first day.
She sucked it up, used a rubber band. Eventually, her husband took pity on her and bought her a new clip. The shopping fast was hard at first. To avoid temptation, she took all the shopping apps off her phone and unsubscribed from promotional emails. And it got easier. She got creative.
I had 2 weddings that summer and I borrowed dresses for both of them.
Even though she lost 20 pounds that year, she didn't buy any new clothes. On January 1st, 2019, the fast was over. Faulkner bought a new pair of jeans. But she says the experiment has changed the way she shops.
I think now I look at every purchase and really question whether or not it's something that I need. And even if it's something that I want, is it something that I love?
Faulkner says one benefit of the shopping fast, she crunched the numbers, it saved her family about $4,000. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Look out for more editions of How We Shop and help us out by sharing your habits at marketplace.org. Now, before we fully embrace the new year, we have one more look back at our roundup of what the 2010s meant for different parts of this economy. Today, I'm joined by Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino to hear how workplace culture changed in the past decade. Hey, Megan.
Hey there.
So give me an overview. What's been going on in workplace culture in the last decade?
Well, the last decade is interesting. I like to kind of view the trends in workplace culture through the kind of lens of the broader economy. We've had the longest economic expansion in modern history. We've had record low unemployment. But in many cases, you know, for workers, particularly low wage workers, it has been a very slow recovery. And in some cases, things that eroded during the Great Recession have not been regained. Benefits, wages were very slow to rise for many workers. So there's this kind of been this tension between security and insecurity in the workplace.
Speaking of insecurity in the workplace, one of the things that's kind of been around forever but really changed in nature in the last decade is the gig economy.
Right. So, of course, Uber came onto the scene about a decade ago and ushered in this, you know, new word that we now use to describe the kind of informal economy that we've had for a while of workers who work gigs, who don't have a lot of security in their jobs. There's a lot of anxiety over what this is going to mean going forward. And this really came to a head in California. We had, you know, kind of a correction here with this new law, AB 5, that kind of seeks to undo the gig economy. So it'll be interesting to watch in 2020 where that goes, if it expands to other states because of these anxieties.
What about worker activism? Does that look any different than it did in, say, 2010?
Well, I think definitely with this kind of relative job security that many workers have enjoyed, we've seen a string of protests in the tech world of workers kind of, you know, protesting against their own employer about everything from climate change policy, sexual harassment policy, immigration policy, and more broadly, I think, you know, our greater choice in employers in this kind of economy is really starting to redefine how people think about their work in terms of their identity and really spurring workers to have more interest in aligning their employer, aligning their work with their personal values.
And we can't really talk about worker activism or even the workplace in the last decade without Me Too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we've seen this kind of surge of speaking out about things like sexual harassment. We've seen in the wake of that, you know, a real recalibration about how workplaces think about diversity and inclusion efforts. It's debatable how much has actually changed since all of this came about, but certainly there's been a lot of reflection about it. So I think coming up in the next year and over the next decade, you know, I think we will start to see these changes manifest in differences in the workplace for women, hopefully.
Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino, thanks.
Thanks.
The markets were closed for New Year's Day, so we'll have some other details coming up when we do the numbers. We head into this new year continuing the low unemployment rates that have been steadily ticking down since the recession. For some, that can mean a lot of job hopping, weighing new and hopefully better offers, and negotiating that offer. That can be especially important for women who make just 82 cents for every dollar paid to men. Rima Kreis, host of Marketplace's This Is Uncomfortable podcast, has a story about one woman's experience negotiating her pay.
About 3 years ago, Caitlin Boston decided she was going to ask her boss for a pay raise.
I knew I was really good at my job, you know, so I felt super prepared.
Caitlin had been working at this design agency in New York for 2 years in user experience research. She was pulling crazy hours and recently landed this massive $5 million project. But when she asked for a raise, her boss gave her this line.
I just don't think you have enough time on yet to really, you know, warrant this.
So then Caitlin did the thing almost all of us do when we're angry at work. She found her closest colleague and vented quietly.
So she was like, how did your conversation go? Are you okay? And I was like, I'm not okay. I'm really not okay. Does this look like I'm okay? Because I'm not okay.
Caitlin and a few of her coworkers decided to go out to eat that night. And over dinner, Caitlin asked them, hey, what do you all make? At the table were all women, and three of them, including Caitlin, had at least 7 years' experience. One had a PhD under her belt. And then there was one woman who was fresh out of college. And it turns out they were all making the same amount of money. Caitlin was furious. She went home that night, and the gears in her head were turning.
I'm going to ask my male coworker tomorrow, who I'm close to, what he's making, because I just need to make sure. I just need to validate that we're all being screwed equally.
And as a person of color, Caitlin says it was especially important for her to ask a white male coworker. But when she pulled him aside the next day, he did not want to share how much he made. So then Caitlin said, if I give you a number, can you at least tell me if it's over or under that?
And I picked what I thought was a really egregiously high number. And he, you know, goes, oh, yeah, I'm making under that. And then I picked a number that was $10,000 less than that. And I said, are you making over under this? And he goes, oh, I'm making over that. And when he said that, then, that's when just, my hair went up and just like lit on flame.
He was making at least $20,000 more than her, even though they both had the same job background, same master's degree, and had been with the company for the same amount of time. That's when Caitlin realized she needed more data. So she cold messaged people on LinkedIn with similar backgrounds and positions, most of them white men, and she found out they were making about the same as what her male coworker was making, a comfortable six-figure salary.
I was in an echelon of salary potential that I had no idea was even possible.
She started applying to new jobs, and within a month, she had gotten four offers. She was most interested in an offer from Etsy. She remembers being on the phone negotiating her position.
When I offered the number, the recruiter just goes, I'm going to have to review this because this was a little bit higher than what we were expecting. And I was like, yeah, this is the minimum I'm going to come in for.
Caitlin and the HR guy go back and forth a couple of rounds. He's not able to match the salary she wants. So then Caitlin brings up the fact that her other job offers are able to match her desired salary.
And he was like, okay, let me see what I can do. And he came back and he said, well, okay, we're willing to offer you X, and I'm going to tell you that you're making more than X, Y, and Z people. And I'm like, okay. And I was like, can you do better? And he just goes, and that's when he told me, I can guarantee you, you are maxing out everything.
She took the job. And so what was the like percentage difference from your previous salary to what they were offering?
It was a 41% jump.
That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What?
It's life-changing money.
Okay, a 41% jump may not happen to all of us, but Caitlin says her experience can be useful to a lot of people outside of tech because what she's basically talking about is advocating for yourself. Employers, she says, need to be held responsible for helping to fix wage gap problems, but by not at least negotiating, you're just holding yourself back.
And if you're going to hold yourself back, particularly in your prime earning years, you're never going to be able to make that up.
So basically, she says, to get that money. I'm Marie McBeis for Marketplace.
This week, we've been hearing from some workers who are 55 and older. It's part of our series, My Economy. This next one comes to us from the courthouses and federal offices of West Virginia.
I'm Dan Hartman. I'm a security guard that works for a private company that provides security services for the federal government. I have to check everybody that comes in for any kind of weapons and anything sharp, dangerous, no guns, knives, no pepper spray. I have to make sure that none of them are carrying that type of thing and keep order in the waiting room while they have the hearings in the courtroom. When I started doing this, I was about 65 or 66. I started out approximately 15 years ago as a part-time guard for the FEMA offices after we had some serious flooding in the area. I had never done security work in the past, so didn't know entirely what to expect, but primarily it was keeping an eye on the facility, making sure that people behave themselves, and of course at times of disaster people are upset. Basically it was a peacekeeping job. I went to Mississippi for a couple of months to help out after Katrina. I went down on the end of September and came home the following June, about 8.5 months. I decided that this was not really what I was intending to do for the rest of my life. So I resigned when I left Mississippi, told them I was quitting. When I got back to West Virginia, they said, oh, no, we don't want you to quit. We want you to continue on. And I said, well, I really never planned it on doing anything, but, you know, part-time I would. Well, part-time has become practically full-time. I'm probably the oldest guard we have right now. We did have a fellow that was a couple years older than me. He failed his shooting test about a year and a half ago. We have to shoot twice a year to keep our qualifications. And I still shoot in around the 94 percentile. And if I wasn't able to do that, I wouldn't be holding down that position.
Dan Hartman, still making it as a part-time security guard in Hartz, West Virginia. Let us know what's going on in your economy at marketplace.org. Coming up,
the sassiness of the dog, or the, you know, how cute their tail is, or that sort of thing.
How you turn good dogs into a business idea. But first, let's do the numbers. The markets are closed today for the New Year's holiday, so a few alternative numbers. 5%. That's the rough median price hike imposed in the U.S. today on more than 200 prescription drugs, according to the research firm 3-Axis Advisors. 863. That's how many aircraft Airbus delivered this past year, tracking sources said today. That puts Airbus ahead of rival Boeing for the first time in 8 years. Boeing has been hit by safety concerns over its 737 MAX jetliner. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hello to 2020 and all the new Marketplace investors who joined us before the end of the decade. Thank you so much for being part of this community of donors who believe in the importance of trustworthy, independent news and information. It's your ongoing support that keeps us going strong and helps make people smarter everywhere. Thanks again and Happy New Year.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. In 2019, we learned more about the costs of climate change, with what seemed like a new report every month warning of rising temperatures, health consequences, more frequent and severe natural disasters, like the fires currently ravaging Australia or the floods that killed at least 9 people in Indonesia today. In November, Venice, Italy experienced devastating flooding. The city's mayor estimated the damage at over €1 billion. A system of floodgates called Mosei, under construction for years, should have prevented the disaster. But the project has suffered delays and is mired in corruption. From Venice, the BBC's Italy correspondent Mark Lowen reports.
From out here on the Venice Lagoon, you can see the whole skyline of this incredible city. I can make out the bell tower of St. Mark's Basilica, and all the amazing little canals that go through this city, one of Europe's jewels. So we're out on the waters, speeding towards what some say could be Venice's salvation, and others, its curse.
Welcome to Mosei. Mosei means experimental electromechanical module.
And it also refers to Moses, no?
Yes, because Venice has to be saved against the sea.
Monica Ambrosini works on one of Italy's most ambitious and controversial engineering projects in its history, the Mosei floodgate system. Barriers built at the 3 inlets to the Venice Lagoon to protect it from acqua alta, or high tides.
Now we enter in the heart of the Mosei system because we are going down in the bottom of the sea under the gates. When we have to raise up the gates, we pump air through this pipe so they raise up, floating. Then, when it's finished, the event of high tide, we extract the air through that pipe so they lower down in their initial position.
Construction began 16 years ago. It was due to finish in 2014, and so could have saved Venice from the latest floods, if so. But that's now been pushed back to 2022. As for the cost, well, that was due to be €1.6 billion, but is now estimated at €5.5 billion. And it's been a den of legal problems. 35 people were arrested for corruption in relation to the project, including the former mayor of Venice.
The problem is that the Italian government considers Mosei too big to fail.
Marco Baravalle is an anti-Mosei activist. Why does he see the project as the problem, not the solution?
For many technical reasons. Let's just say one, the problem of the connections. These parts, even if the Mosei is not yet working, are already totally rusted and destroyed. Then there are some financial objections concerning the maintenance of Mosei. And then, last but not least, there are like climate change issue, because the raising of the sea level would totally take out of the game a system like Mosei, which is very old in terms of design.
St. Mark's Square, Venice's tourist heart, bore the brunt of the floods, and inside the Byzantine Basilica, the damage is clear. The floodwater reached the incredible 13th century mosaic floor of the basilica. I'm standing in front of one part here which shows two peacocks facing each other, and they've had to be covered with a sort of fabric gauze because the individual stones of the mosaic were ripped away by the force of the water.
Venezia che muore, Venezia appoggiata sul mare.
For 1,000 years, the sea made Venice the heart of a powerful empire. Now, in just 100 years, projections say the city could sink. Morse's floodgates may stop that. At stake, whether Venice survives or becomes just an underwater theme park. In Venice, I'm the BBC's Mark Lowen for Marketplace.
This holiday season, you may have pulled out a board game to play with friends and family, like Monopoly, Mancala, maybe even Cards Against Humanity. But have you ever thought about the origins of new games? Here to tell us a little bit about the business behind them is Darren Watts. He's a freelance game designer and has spent the past 20 years designing board and card games. He's the co-designer, along with Ben Walker and Stephen Tasker, of the new game We Rate Dogs, based on the Twitter account of the same name. Welcome, Darren.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you end up as a board game designer? It's not really one of those jobs where you think kids are like, oh, when I grow up, I want to design board games.
Right. I was a hobbyist first, and the opportunity came up to acquire the intellectual property of a game that had been one of my favorite games as a child, which is called Champions. It's a superhero tabletop role-playing game. And with several friends of mine, we put out a new rule set and, you know, and updated it to the current standards for game design. And it was a surprise hit. And we suddenly realized, well, this is now our full-time job, I guess. We kind of expected it to be, you know, sort of a side gig for us, but it was unexpectedly successful.
That must have been really cool, like nostalgia to the nth degree.
Exactly. I've always been able to say when I talk to other fans of it, right, this is, you know, I'm such a fan that I grew up and bought the company.
What is the business model behind the board game business? I understand you call it the tabletop game business, although when my siblings and I were playing as kids, we were always playing on the floor.
Basically, tabletop is just kind of a broad term that basically includes everything that is not electronic, right? So it might be board games, it might be card games, Dungeons and Dragons, that sort of thing. Basically anything that has, you know, traditional analog pieces to it as opposed to being something that you play on a computer.
You were talking about sort of the analog nature of tabletop or board games. In our sort of goldfish attention span world, is there really right. still a lot of interest in people sitting down with something so analog?
I think that's precisely why there is an interest, because you have so few other opportunities to do that. That the, you know, kind of like making a commitment to, oh, we're going to sit around a table for a couple of hours and just interact and talk and be sociable is actually kind of like a relatively rare experience for people these days. And it's something that they sort of crave. You can get 5 or 6 people to have this interactive social experience and enjoy themselves, which is a much better, you know, cost effectiveness than going to a movie or something like that, right? It's you can get hundreds of hours of entertainment out of a board game for a relatively small cost.
What's the balance of sort of new original board games as opposed to, say, the 18,000th version of Monopoly?
We're actually in a kind of a, you know, a new golden age of design for that. There are hundreds and hundreds of new games reaching store shelves, reaching distribution every month.
So how does somebody come up with a new board game?
You either start with a mechanic, a way of playing the game, a set of rules that make sense that you then look for a theme for, or you start from the other direction where you have a theme and then figure out a way to actually kind of like replicate to the feel of what it is that you want the players to be doing. In the case of We Rate Dogs, we started with the idea that we wanted to make a game about dog shows. But the aesthetic of We Rate Dogs is kind of against breeds, right? It's mutts are awesome. So we kind of went back and rewrote everything that we had done to accommodate the, you know, the sassiness of the dog or the, you know, how cute their tail is or that sort of thing. And that made our game 100 times better.
Designing board games sounds like a lot of fun, but given what you've described, it could also be pretty meticulous and tedious. Is it fun?
It is fun. I mean, you have to be interested in, you know, the math. You have to be interested in probability and that sort of thing. But once that's okay, then it's tremendous fun. I mean, we get to get up every day, and our job is how do we help people have more fun? And that's a relatively easy way to face yourself in the morning.
All right. Darren Watts is a freelance game designer. His latest board game is called We Rate Dogs, published by Chronicle Books. It's in stores now. Thanks so much, Darren.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out, if you happen to have a New Year's resolution to stay more informed, which would track if you're listening to public radio on a holiday, we have an Alexa skill to help out. For example, if you also have a resolution to work out more and you notice the gym is a little crowded over the next few days, well, gyms bank on that, and they rely on most of us not sticking to our resolutions all year. We have an explainer all about the gym business. If you have an Echo device, say, make me smart, and take a listen. We've got to go. The markets were closed today for the New Year holiday. Traders will be back trading again tomorrow. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.